Well, this hour, we'll take your phone calls with Lisa Pease. Her book, A Lie Too Big to Fail. It's a serious investigation of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. One of her prior books, The Assassinations, as she looked at the JFK, Martin Luther King, RFK, and Malcolm X murders as well. But we'll be back with Lisa, your phone calls, and much more next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're back with researcher and author Lisa Pease. Her book, A Lie Too Big to Fail. We'll tell you where you can pick this book up, especially those of you who are into this genre. Lisa, I once knew as a reporter an individual who was probably the first person to say that he did not believe Sirhan Sirhan was the assassin of Robert F. Kennedy. His name was M.T. Mahdi, and he lived in New York, and he was running an agency for Palestinian rights. And, you know, initially when he first said that, I'm going, come on.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like you, the more I investigated, the more I heard things, things just didn't make sense. And then when I interviewed William Pepper, you know, it made even more sense that there was something very strange going on here. What do you think, and then we'll get into calls, the motivation was to assassinate Robert F. Kennedy? Why did they want him out?
Yeah, I think they wanted him out for the same reasons. Again, I think people wanted Kennedy out. If you zoom way out, at its core, the Kennedy brothers stood for cooperation with other nations, whereas, for example, the Dulles brothers, who ran both the overt and covert foreign policy of the U.S. for 8 years together, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, they believed in U.S. should dominate the rest of the world, not cooperate.
And they hated Kennedy. Kennedy bopped one out of the CIA, didn't he?
Yeah. And Kennedy was on the side of the little guy. It's like he understood that all these nations that were having their own little communist revolutions, he knew it wasn't about communism. It was about independence and nationalism, independence from the global empire powers. You know, rebelling against the British government, you know, for decades of domination and so on. And so he supported that. He supported Lumumba in the Congo, which is why the CIA rushed to kill him before Kennedy took, you know, the oath of office, so that, you know, because they were...
Well, what about Diem in the Vietnam?
Right.
Same thing. I was told Kennedy was in shock when he heard that Diem had been assassinated.
He was, and he was trying very hard to prevent that because he somehow naively thought that you could overthrow a government and not kill somebody because, you know, they were trying to remove him, and he did feel some guilt towards that. But it's, you know, overall, he was trying to find ways to cooperate, like Sukarno in Indonesia, you know, yet another leader who was overthrown as soon as, you know, the Kennedys were out of office in 1965. The CIA foments a fake coup and then supports the counter coup that's supposed to be there to protect Sukarno, but in fact ousts Sukarno. And this was happening all over the globe. In fact, there was a wonderful book, Thy Will Be Done, by Jared Colby and Charlotte Dennett, and one of their sections is called something like, I can't even remember the name of it, but it's like every leftist leader in the hemisphere was taken out in a very short period of time. And if the Kennedys were not taken out, they would have been the anomaly because every other one had to go, you know, as Arbenz in Guatemala and the guy Goulart in Brazil. And I'm not talking, again, these aren't communists. These are just ordinary kind of liberal leaders who weren't right-wing fascist dictators. And that's the really sad thing, is that we look now like in Iran. Look what a mess they've become. And they were a democratic form of government. They were a secular society until we and the British joined forces to overthrow Mossadegh.
Exactly.
And now they've become this fundamentalist wreck of a country. You know, apologies to Iranians. I'm not trying to criticize, but it's like it's partly our fault. And look at this caravan of immigrants coming from Latin America. Well, why are they coming here? Because we overthrew their you know, fairly normal leaders and put in these right-wing people who are very friendly to the business communities at the expense of the ordinary citizens in a lot of these countries. And they got poorer and poorer to the point where they look to the rich neighbors to the north and say, we want that. You know, we've been very good at selling the American dream, you know, come to America and, you know, the poorest man can become a rich person. And But in any case, the Kennedys didn't believe in enslaving other nations. They didn't believe in that. They really tried to promote fairness. And that was threatening to a lot of the big business interests across the country. And who does the CIA and the military serve? They serve these big business interests. You know, there's no point. You know, what's his name? The guy who tried to prevented the overthrow of FDR, Smedley Butler, in the Marine Corps back, you know, in the early part of the last century. He said war is a racket. You know, here we are defending oil companies. You know, we're not really defending people. We're defending property. And it really offended him because he's like, people are dying for this, and we shouldn't be here just to defend an oil pipeline or something. And he was very upset about that. And again, as were the Kennedys, which is why they didn't want us to get too embroiled in Vietnam. And I know Chomsky disagrees. I even had an email exchange with Chomsky years ago about this. But all the records and the evidence that have come out over the last few years, Kennedy was hell-bent on getting us out of Vietnam. He knew it was not winnable, and Robert Kennedy knew it wasn't winnable. And Robert Kennedy admitted, like, there was a point where he kind of thought it was and that he was totally wrong. He admitted that while he was living. He's like, we should never have gone in. We should never have, you know, been there at all, and it's not our fight, and we got to get out as fast as we can. And he was anti-war till the day he died. Martin Luther King killed, you know, just a couple of months before Robert Kennedy in that same horrible year of 1968, also killed a year to the day after his anti-war.
That's true. Let me ask you a question about Robert Kennedy Jr., who's been on our program before, and I've been told mentions you in his latest book, American Values. Tell me about that.
Yes. David Talbot, the founder of Salon and the author of a great book on Alan Dulles called The Devil's Chip.
Yep, and he's been on our program many times.
Good. Well, David Talbot wanted me to talk to Bobby Kennedy about something that he was interested in. He's like, who would know about this? I'm like, I do. Give him to me. I want to talk to him. And I was so excited to meet a member of the Kennedy family after having studied their lives and deaths for so many years. And so he had me over to his house. He's now living out on the West Coast because his wife, you know, has a real job in Hollywood. And
hates vaccines. He hates vaccines.
Just to be clear, because a lot of people, I think, oversimplify that. He doesn't hate vaccines. He hates toxic metals in vaccines given to little kids who
are in vaccines.
Yeah. Right, but that doesn't mean you're anti-vaccine, because there are vaccines that are heavy metal-free, and that's a totally different thing.
Unfortunately, not enough.
Right. I do feel one of the biggest problems facing America is that we tend to think in binary terms. Somebody is either pro this or anti this, and we miss the nuance that makes all the difference.
As we go to calls, where do we get your book, A Lie Too Big to Fail?
You can get it on Amazon. Supposedly you can get it in Barnes & Noble, although I've yet to see it on the shelves, but it is listed there. But if you go to Amazon.com, if you search A Lie Too Big to Fail, you may not find it. But if you search my name, Lisa Pease, P-E-A-S-E, you will definitely find it. And I definitely encourage you, like I said, this is 25 years of research I'm giving you guys. It's not, you know, a lot of the authors in this case look at the case 2, 3, 4 years, and then they write a book. And so how much new stuff can they have? People who've read this, who know the case already, are shocked at how much I have. In fact, a reporter...
Well, it's a lot of details.
Yeah. People are like, how did you find all these witnesses? I'm like, 25 freaking years! It's taken a long time. And I would read targeted for about 80% of the time, and then I would just kind of wander through the files for the last 25... You know, I just randomly put a microfilm reel in, and now, of course, the files are online at maryferrell.com, a wonderful site that has a lot of our lost history documented and searchable, although not everything comes up in a search engine, even if it's there. So if you search and you don't find something, that doesn't mean it's not there. It may mean that word scanned poorly and didn't show up in the search.
All right, let's go to some calls for you. First-time caller, Malni in Orange, California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Malni.
Hi, George. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
How are you?
Good. I'm doing very well. I actually know Lisa. I have a question. It's been a long time, but this case has fascinated America. This is the 50th anniversary year of that tragic year. Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who's in his 90s now, was the L.A. County coroner at the time. Mm-hmm. And were you able to interview him recently for your book and get his analysis? Because, as we know at the time, he testified that there was basically a fatal point-blank shot behind the ear. He almost lost his job because of that. And then secondly, regarding the polka dot dress woman, There's been so much speculation about that lady. Has anyone followed any solid leads on her to discover her identity, or is that
all right? So two questions, and I'll talk about them both briefly. Although I did not interview Noguchi, and I really tried because Cyril Wecht is a friend of mine and a friend of Noguchi's, and he's decided not to really talk much about the case. Second, Wolfer was even put the bullet even closer than Noguchi did, and people don't know this because people credit Noguchi with, you know, putting the distance too close for Sirhan to have made it. But Wolfer put the shots in the back because Kennedy was shot four times. One went through the clothes, but it wasn't just shot behind the ear. He was also shot twice more, kind of from the underarm area, and then one shot was so steep it went through his coat without piercing the skin. But Wolfer put those shots at 3/4 of an inch. So we're talking somebody whose gun is
that was right there,
Kennedy,
yeah,
and behind him and under the arm. I mean, and St. Caesar just happened to be holding his left elbow, and he was right-handed. If you can picture yourself in that position, who better to make those shots? I don't know if he did, but no one was in a better position to make those shots. So that's one. Now, you ask about the girl in the polka dot.
Yeah, what's the significance of that?
Yeah, there was a woman who ran out at the back saying, we shot him, and a girl happened to be sitting on the back stairs as this happened, and she said, who did you shoot? And she said, Senator Kennedy, and ran off into the dark. She was accompanied by a man in a gold shirt, and I actually have about 8 witnesses to Sirhan, the guy in the gold shirt, and the girl in the polka dot dress being seen kind of together, you know, throughout the night by this group of girls, and I contacted one of them because Sandy Serrano, who was a girl on the polka dot dress, the police got her to basically recant and say she didn't say that. I use a large chunk of one chapter to show what the police did to get her to recant. It was like psychological warfare they pulled on her. In fact, one of the cops involved said that they should have gone to jail for what they did to her. But there was another witness to that conversation. So what Sandy said was 100% true, and the police knew it. And again, there was somebody else on the record who had said that, and of course they went and made her recant. She was much younger and recanted much more quickly than Sandy did. You know, they brought her in front of her parents and, you know, made it sound like she was going to commit a crime if she kept saying that. And so, of course, she recanted. But I caught up with her in later years. I'm like, why did you notice these people? And she said, well, you don't understand, because today campaigns are pretty informal events. She goes, but in that time, everybody really dressed up. It was like a really big deal to go to a campaign party. I mean, people were in like formal attire. So when you see this girl in this kind of, you know, ratty little polka dot dress and this guy in jeans, they just stuck out like sore thumbs. And they were not happy. They were not in a party mood. They definitely stuck out. And that made it clear to me, because I always wondered, why did so many people notice this trio of people? And in the pantry later, it was a girl in a polka dot dress who was seen with Sirhan moments before the shooting by Vince DiPiero. And Vince DiPiero at the trial kind of identified this woman named Valerie Schulte as the girl in the polka dot dress, but that was kind of a setup. And when I talked to him and I showed him the pictures and I said, you know, Valerie Schulte was blonde. I said, didn't you say the girl was a brunette? He goes, yes, she was absolutely a brunette. And I said, and wasn't she wearing a polka dot dress? Because this is really a green dress with lemons on it. It's not really polka dot. He goes, oh, yeah, that wasn't the dress. I never meant to say that was the dress. And the more I talked to him, it was like, it was clear that that was not the woman he had seen with Sirhan. So police did that. But anyway, but the girl he did see with Sirhan was practically holding him. He was standing on a tray stacker, and I realized later the reason for that is that gave them a little height over the crowd, and she was standing behind him kind of holding, you know, with her arms around him, holding onto the tray stacker herself, because then they could see when Kennedy entered the room. And in hypnosis, Sirhan talks about the girl and what he remembers, and at one point the girl looks up and to the right. And I know why she did that, because there was a shooter on the kitchen table that he shot Sirhan. At no point did Sirhan ever get on the table until he was pushed there by Carl Yucker after the shooting had started. But 3 really solid, incredible witnesses that I name in my book saw a shooter on the table shooting down into the crowd.
Wow.
And again, this makes sense.
How could you make that up? No, nobody could make that up. Right?
You can't make it up. I mean, it's funny. It's even in, there was like a San Antonio paper that said, that had a picture of the pantry, and it literally put somebody on the table and said the shooter stood here. And I tried to find, you know, the writer of that to find out, you know, who did he talk to, but I assume it was probably one of the 3 I might have.
Is it possible, Lisa, that in the pandemonium of what was happening, that the security guard who was close to Robert F. Kennedy may have accidentally shot him by with the flurry of everything that was going on?
Not accidentally. And this gets into kind of how I end my book, so I don't want to give too much away.
I understand. I understand.
To read it. But that security guard was working for one of the top CIA cutouts who ran assassination plots
for
the agency. And that's just a stunning connected of the dots.
That's weird.
And I talked to a guy who kept a daily diary for decades of his time in a certain organization, and the conversations before and after the assassination are pretty stunning, and I'll leave it at that.
Have you ever been threatened? You know too much.
I haven't. Here's what I want people to know. People will threaten because they want to scare you off. They don't want you to tell the truth, but they won't follow through. And frankly, if they're going to follow through, they're not going to threaten because that leaves a trail. You know, that's a phone call.
They just do it. Right.
They just do it. And the thing is, this is more than 50 years ago. It's like no one in the CIA right now cares. You know, they got bigger fish to fry. They're all focused on, you know, Russia and Trump and, you know, everything else that's going on in the world. So this is way off the radar. So if anybody feels, because I have friends who are like, oh, my God, I don't want to read your book. What if somebody kills me? I'm like, they're not going to kill you.
Well, Robert F. Kennedy was well on his way to getting the Democratic nomination. Do you think he would have beaten Richard Nixon? His brother did. Do you think he would have beaten Richard Nixon in a runoff?
Yeah, I think he would have. And I think the evidence is right there in the pictures of the people lining the tracks again along the train. You know, literally like 2 million people or something came out to see that funeral train. He was like a rock star in politics. I mean, his brother was popular. Bobby was like twice as popular.
Right. Well, for two reasons. One, because of the brother's death.
Right.
You know,
right.
There was a lot of sympathy
for him. Exactly. But also, he really embraced the poor in a way even his brother had never gone that far. He would go into homes in the South where there were diseased black children and pick them up and hold them in his arms. And this is something white politicians just didn't do at that point in time. This was the 60s, you know, segregation was rampant. And so he reached people on a very emotional level, and that's what wins elections. So I absolutely think he would have. And I think Nixon knew that and was terrified, and certainly, you know, other people. And, of course, if he had been elected, he did tell friends that one of the things he wanted to do was investigate his brother's death. He also wanted to rein in the CIA more, and he wanted to do these things pretty much immediately upon taking office. And neither of those things were ever going to be allowed to happen. So
55 years since John F. Kennedy was assassinated, 50 years since Robert Kennedy, 50 years since Martin Luther King was gunned down. And I'm not sure James Earl Ray was the culprit in that case. And even Martin
right.
Luther King's family doesn't believe that James Earl Ray was the assassin there either.
But
being over 50 years... and think of this question, Lisa, when we come back after the break. Do people still care about these cases? What do you think?
Yeah, we'll talk.
All right. Lisa Pease with us. The name of her book, A Lie Too Big to Fail. Her website, of course, Blogspot, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. And her other book is called The Assassins. Next hour, John D'Souza joins us as we will talk about real-life X-Files. So get ready for that on Coast to Coast. And we'll take phone calls with you then in the last hour of the program. But when we come back in just a moment, we'll take final phone calls with Lisa Pease as we talk about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And welcome back to Coast, Lisa Pease with us. We'll take final phone calls here. Lisa, so the question was, after 50, 55 years since these assassinations, does anybody still care? What do you think?
Well, first, clearly the listeners of your show do, or they wouldn't be here.
Oh, yeah, they care. They care.
And I think it's the difference of people who take the short view of life and just look at, like, their next paycheck and the next step and whatever they're doing that day versus people who have a bigger concern about humanity as a whole. History does repeat itself until you learn not to repeat it. I mean, slavery lasted many thousands of years until finally enough people got together and said no more. And by studying these cases, you learn templates for how the world really works, how cover-ups are affected. And my argument is once you learn how the magic trick works, you can never be fooled again. So I think it's really critical to study these. But I also want to add one other component. Lee Harvey Oswald is dead. John Kennedy is dead. Martin Luther King is dead. James Earl Ray is dead. Robert Kennedy is dead. But Sirhan Sirhan is still alive and sitting in jail, and he's lost 50 years of his life by being tricked into committing a crime he didn't even know he was
committing. How do you think they found him originally to become that Manchurian candidate?
I think after his horse accident, because he was a exercise boy at a track out in Corona, you know, working for some private stable owners. And that area has a lot of intelligence personnel, shall we say. But after falling from a horse and getting very badly bruised with external injuries and even a couple of internal injuries, but we were told it was all minor injuries, and yet he goes to the doctor very often, once or twice a month for the next 13 months. That doesn't compute. If it's, you know, mostly bruises and, you know, there were no fractures, there was no serious damage, you know, everybody said, you know, it was pretty minor injuries. And so then, you know, I've had much worse injuries than that, and I have not gone to the doctor twice a month for 13 months. And so I think the doctor visits were maybe programming sessions, you know, where this was taking place, because it's not easy to program somebody to that degree. Although, boy, that woman next to me at that hypnosis thing, I mean, she went under quickly and, you know, and totally believed that fake check, as I described earlier. There is something very sinister about hypnosis, and it's so powerful. And here's the other lie. They say you can never be made to do something you wouldn't do outside of hypnosis. And while that's technically true, it's not literally true. Meaning, if I hypnotized you, George, and I said, go kill your mother, you wouldn't do it. All right. But if I hypnotized you and managed to convince you that your mother was really a Russian agent who is there to kill you if you didn't kill her first, and that she'd been taught to exactly mimic your mother's look and sound and cry like your mother, I might get you to kill your mother.
Well, it's got to be done in a perfect way, because as you mentioned, you can't force someone under hypnosis to do what they would not normally have done if they weren't hypnotized.
Right, but you can trick them into hypnosis, into believing an alternate reality, and that's the part they always leave out when they're talking to you, and that's what I'm convinced happened to Sirhan. And so, I end my book with a plea to free Sirhan. It's not fair that his poor family, they were part of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. They're Christians, by the way. I mean, the whole family is Christians. There's not a Muslim in the bunch.
Are you in a regular conversation mode with his brother at any time?
Yes.
Okay, I want to do this. I want you to get Tom some information. I'm going to talk to the brother about a friend of Sirhan's that I knew that could comfort him to try to get us permission. And if we do, I want you with me when we go to interview him, all right?
I would love that.
See if we can pull that off. Let's go to the phones now. Final segment here with Lisa Pease. Frank in Hollywood, Maryland is with us. Frank, go ahead, sir.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. Lisa answered all my questions basically about the lady in the polka dot dress.
Okay.
Her nationality and all. But when she ran out of there, did the people confuse her anguish with a rejoice? Did she say they killed him or we killed him? And then my second question is, Roosevelt Greer and the other sports figure, I know the man like the back of my hand, but I see his name, but I can't.
Rayford Johnson.
Rayford, right.
That's what Rosie kept. The announcer kept saying, get the gun, Rayford. Get the gun. Remember?
Did you interview them?
I didn't, but I did see Rosie Greer at the 50th anniversary celebration of his life, obviously not of his death, at the Robert Kennedy Schools. And he's like 90 years old now, and he was moving very slowly, and it was clear he wasn't going to talk to anyone. But I did at least get to see him, you know, quite an impressive man, Rosie Greer. Going back to the girl, she said we shot him. And in my book, by the way,
we shot him,
not they shot him. And she was very happy, and Sandy Serrano was very upset by that she seemed like giddy happy about it. And I believe the reason she was saying that, because people are like, why would she run out and say that to a total stranger? She wasn't talking to Sandy. As she's running out the door, there was a man standing right by that back entrance who had been there the whole time in a maroon suit holding something up to his cheek, according to two witnesses, it looked like a radio. I think he was there guarding the exit and making sure it was going to be available to them. And then before he left, he turned to these two women who'd been watching him all night and said, "You've seen me here all night. I wasn't involved." You know, like he was establishing an alibi. But I think the girl, when she saw that guy, I think she recognized the team member and said, "We shot him. We shot him." And Sandy just heard it. And they were almost past her when she said, "We shot Kennedy." And at that point, they were free and clear. They knew they were on their way to their, you know, getaway car and no more problems. So they didn't care if she heard the tail end of that conversation.
Lisa, there's lots of evidence that kind of points towards something other than a lone Sirhan Sirhan gunman. But what would you say may be the single biggest factor that has even convinced you that Sirhan Sirhan either didn't do it or definitely didn't do it alone?
Yeah, that he didn't do it alone to me was the holes in the pantry door frames, because that was four more bullet holes than could possibly have come from a single gun. So to me, that was very convincing evidence. And there are numerous witnesses to the fact that those were bullet holes and not pencil holes, as the police tried to say, including that video I alluded to earlier, where only something as small as a .22 could have penetrated the paneling and made those holes and then been dug out and left a bigger hole behind than there was in front. So that answers that part of it. And again, why I don't think Sirhan did it, along with the hypnosis angle, is the fact that the police had to switch any bullets at all. If Sirhan had been firing any bullets, they would have used the test bullets from his gun to make up the other victim bullets. But the problem was they didn't know they had a problem until they had given Sirhan's gun to the grand jury, and then they realized that his bullets didn't match anything else. And then it was too late to, like, dummy up enough evidence, you know, to frame him. So they could at least make bullets that matched each other, but they couldn't make bullets that matched his gun because his gun was gone by then. And in fact, during the trial, Wolfer even used a different gun with a very close serial number. There's a film called The Second Gun that's about a serial number that's very far away from Sirhan's. But there was a gun that was entered into evidence at the trial that had a very close serial number. Wolfer talked about this. And I think he literally brought the wrong gun into the trial.
Jeez.
So that when he said these bullets came from this gun and no other, his voice had the ring of truth, because it was. It just wasn't the same gun, but the bullets definitely did come from that gun. And again, this is why it's important to read this. I want lawyers to read this. I want defense attorneys to read this, because if these are the tactics, again, this can't be limited to L.A. I imagine police all over the country do things. And not all police, you know, don't get me wrong. You know, a lot of great people in the police department, and I've certainly been helped over the years, and I'm sure many of your listeners have too. But there are bad seeds in any organization, and as a lot of people know, sometimes the bad seeds collude and get to the top and then keep all the good seeds down. So that could be a problem in the police department as well as anywhere else. So this book kind of lifts the lid on the kinds of frame-ups that go on. So when I saw that the bullets had been switched, and I didn't believe that first, when somebody pointed this out to me, I'm like, oh, my God, they wouldn't go that far. That's just crazy. And it took me a while to come to terms with that, even when I'm staring the evidence in the face. I'm looking at the roster, and I can see the ID marks don't match, and I'm still, like, racking my brain for any other explanation, because that was just, like, world-changing to me. That really, really bothered me that they would go to that length. But then again, you know, over time, you're like, of course they would go to that length, and they've probably done it before and since. And that's why I named my book A Lie Too Big to Fail, because if you understand what happened to Sirhan, then you actually have to re-question all the cases that happened under Wolfer during that period of time. And that's a huge amount of money for the county to bear. It literally became a lie that was too big to fail, and they had to prop it up at any cost because it would reopen all of these cases. If you figured out that one case was rigged, how many others were rigged?
Were they told to rig it?
That's the question, isn't it? And in a way, they were, in the sense that early on, like within the first hour on police radio, there are other suspects. There are literally six different suspects, and I list them all in my book, that are being announced that people saw running from the hotel with guns. And, you know, they had reason to suspect these people.
My gosh.
Involved. Multiple witnesses to some of these. And then the commander gets on the line, and he goes, well, we have Rayford Johnson, and he was right next to the guy, and he says there was only one shooter, and we don't want to get anybody started on big conspiracy. And that was kind of like the boom coming down. Like, that was his way of saying, cut off this talk of conspiracy. Now, if you look at what Rafer actually said, he didn't say he saw only one shooter. He said he only noticed one shooter, and he didn't look around for other shooters. He's like, if there was somebody else there, I wouldn't have seen him, you know, which is quite a different thing than saying, oh, there was only one shooter. You know, he said, I only saw the one guy because once I saw him, I didn't take my eyes off him, which is, again, and here's the other thing. And in my book, I talk about the people, the other shooters all look like Sirhan. People described them, and they all had very similar facial features.
Interesting.
Even though they were different heights and weights.
Confused people.
Had a similar face.
Let's go to Ray in Exeter, California. Hey, Ray, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, George. Great guest and great show tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I wrote a book last year by, Sean O'Sullivan. It was called Who Killed Bobby? And he covered several of the major points that Lisa has covered in her great new book. And I took away from it that there's no question that there was another shooter. And the fact that one of the most respected coroners in the United States, Thomas Noguchi, swore under testimony. They tried to force him to change his testimony, but he testified that, yeah, there were actually burns on Senator Kennedy's neck, and that he shot from literally point-blank range. And that would have been impossible for Sirhan to have done, because every single last eyewitness has him no closer than 2 to 2.5 feet from Senator Kennedy, basically in front of him and off to the side. Now, there was a Cuban exile from a security company named Fain Eugene Cesar, who had Senator Kennedy's arm. He was the one that had his hand on Senator Kennedy's arm. And there's conflicting evidence as to whether anybody saw him pull his pistol out. But he was the one that was closest to Senator Kennedy during this entire period of the shooting. And Fain Eugene Cesar was filling in that night. And he had moved out of California sometime after the shooting. He lived in Valley, California for a little while, and now I think he's living in the Philippines. He's living there comfortably, but it doesn't appear as though he has a lot of money, but of course that doesn't really mean anything. And so there's no question about the fact with the ceiling panels, the bullet holes in those, the amount of shots fired, no doubt that there was a conspiracy in that. You know, I'm really happy that Ms. Peace has done great work, is on this evening, because you've had a couple of people on your show recently that pushed this idea that it was just organized crime that was involved in these assassinations that killed the two Kennedys. Mm-hmm. And they were involved, but they were by no means the primary dominant force in the assassinations of both of the brothers. And you posed the question, George, that who cares after 55 and 50 years? Well, it's really not so much the CIA. They're just a bunch of political appointees and government bureaucrats. It's the people that control the CIA. And you know just as well as me in this piece, and people who have done some reading in this country, and there should be a lot more people who should pay attention and do more reading of great sources about these types of national security issues and our post-World War II history and the assassinations, that the CIA was set up to serve the interests of the great financial institutions of the East Coast of the United States. And it was those
bankers and lawyers, that's who actually were part. It's like the CIA doesn't just serve the establishment. It was the establishment. I mean, it literally was the ruling families. Their sons and daughters were off running around spending their own private wealth to do whatever they wanted around the globe. You know, they had common interests, so they joined together, and they self-funded for a while until, you know, they got official budgets from Congress. And then there's a great story about that. They actually dummied up reports. They took stuff out of the New York Times and made it look like it came from a secret intelligence source, because they didn't have sources all over the globe, but they had to convince Congress they did. And Congress was like, wow, yeah, that must be true. I just heard that from the New York Times. Not knowing it was the same source. So, yeah, but that's it. It's not only that they served the establishment, they literally were the establishment at that point in time. And I think that's a point that's often missed.
Lisa, I'm going to put you on hold. You can talk with Tom about the information of Sirhan's brother and see if we can work jointly in getting an interview with him. Wouldn't that be something?
Sure.
What would be your first question to Sirhan?
Oh, my gosh. What would you like to do when you're free?
Mine would be, so you don't think you did it.
Well, here's the thing. he really doesn't have any memory.
No, he doesn't. Even though in the beginning he kind of admitted that he did it as his attorney pushed him to do that. He changed his mind. He recanted, basically, and then has constantly said he doesn't remember, even after all these years. We will be back in a moment as we talk about some real X-Files next on Coast to Coast AM.